Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast, a conversation about martial arts, focusing on Kenpo, but we may cover other things as well. I am Reggie Darden, and I have with me a great guest here, Mark Arnott, and we're just going to talk Kenpo and go through our journeys here. It's just a kind of little brief background on my history there. I originally started Kenpo in the mid 90s, early mid 90s at what was essentially a Tracy's Kenpo school. I did that for about 2 or 3 years, got to my green belt, in which time I had to leave for the Army. While I was in the Army, I did a little bit of Taekwondo, a little bit of Hapkido, a little bit of boxing. Once I got out, I still wanted to train, but couldn't quite find the school that that I wanted to be a part of. So I did happen to come across a Capoeira school and instantly fell in love with that. And I've been doing Capoeira for coming up on 17 years now. About 2 or 3 years ago, I wanted to find myself back in the good graces of Kenpo. And so I found a school that met my criteria, and I've been training in an American Kenpo, Ed Parker version of Kenpo for the last few years now. And as of this recording, I'm I guess about two or three weeks since my green belt test, and now rocking the green belt and working my way towards that that third brown. So, getting really serious now, and can't coast on the, I don't know anything, cause I'm a lower belt. So just really been enjoying that, and just continuing the training and enjoying it. So that's my story. So like to hear about, how Kenpo found you and your journey, and we'll just kind of go from there.
Well, Mr. Darden, it's a pleasure to meet you, man. I'm looking forward to this. Looking forward to this conversation. You sound like you've had a very interesting journey to here, and it's yeah. I was before we started, I was asking about things that the Capoeira part of your journey, and I still want to know. Well, I was asking you about sparring in a Capoeira studio, but were you able to steal stuff? Because now, for me, art is theft in a big way. Were you able to take stuff from Capoeira to use in Kenpo?
Yes and no. I would say that kind of the confidence part of it and going more, I guess, going more hard or committing more to movement. So in Capoeira, it's, it's constant movement, and because we're not, kind of purposely trying to connect the techniques, we can go kind of full, kind of full energy, full intensity, kind of full commitment. So in kind of the kind of vein of like looking at like sparring, like I'm much more confident in sparring because I have that experience of kind of the distance between me and the other person, the control of my kicks, because I'm throwing my kicks at more full speed, I know how to control them better. Since Capoeira is more primarily kicking techniques, my kicking is a lot better, which I've always been a kicker. My original teacher, he did have experience with Taekwondo. So as far as Kenpo schools go, we were much more of a kicking school than Kenpo schools typically are known for. So I would say just, that confidence and that control was something that, the Capoeira training very much helped me with. Capoeira doesn't have, self-defense techniques in the same, it really doesn't have self-defense techniques other than, if you're trying to hurt me and I kick you in the face, then you know, that's going to stop you, or, you know, if I elbow you to the chin or something. But, you know, we don't have, you know, I would say, you know, rehearsed, you know, quote unquote rehearsed self-defense techniques or anything like that. It's all just very on the fly, and, you know, not scripted or anything like that.
For Kenpo, that really, I think defines it is our, those deeply rehearsed techniques. You do it one way, you do it one way all the time, that help you learn the principles behind it and make habits out of the vocabulary, the stances, the weapons, the movement. And, you know, that's it for the student, but then also for the attacker, that you're memorizing the what the targets are by always giving your partner the chance to make real and solid contact. And I think it's one of the things that we cannot afford to overlook when teaching Kenpo, is that it has to be about, it gives us an opportunity for contact, which is just a, you know, if you're ever in a fight, that first hit is just such a surprising insult. I can't believe you actually hit me. It's like, and it kind of sets you back on, whoa. But if you're in a habit of the strike happens, you go into the next thing. That's one of the, but certainly one of the advantages of Kenpo, and can certainly always be a danger that, well, I, the yellow card I use, I started with Larry Tatum. And, I would go back to your original question about me starting. I started with Larry Tatum. And I started because I wanted something for my boy, who was then 4. And so we joined up with Larry, and there was a family discount. His mom and I and my boy, we all joined up, and it stuck deepest with me that there it, after first, well, it, this became, I've been teaching for, that was like 30 years ago that I started. And I didn't open, I've been teaching with Larry. Larry started me teaching very early as an orange belt. It was I was teaching my pals. And I continued teaching all the way through since then, and didn't open my own dojo. I mean, that was fairly recent, just in 2011. And now, like 30 years in, I do feel like I'm beginning to get a handle on it, or at least I'm beginning to get a handle on short form one. I'm really starting to understand the patterns in that. It's odd how when you start to understand something that's vast, you start to understand simple bits of it. Those simple bits are then in everything. It's like a deeper understanding over the same materials that I'd be understanding in long 4, long 8, or actually my favorite kata is really short 3. That was my brown belt thesis was about short 3. Actually, my brown belt thesis was about, it was really about learning how to use Photoshop. Look, you can begin and end this at the same spot. Isn't this cool? And my teacher at the time, when I started with Larry, and his lead teacher was a brilliant martial artist, Rick Jeffco. And Rick moved, do you know Rick?
I'm familiar.
And when he moved on to start his own dojo, well, this was when I first began to understand kind of something of more of the world of Kenpo and martial arts, and maybe in the real world aspect of it. Oh, I thought, well, this is great. I'll just take private lessons with both of them. Because I was taking private lessons with Larry and with Rick on the mat like every week. And I thought that would be fine to continue that when Rick left. But as it turns out, and often happens, they didn't leave on, they didn't part on the best of terms. And I didn't realize they were, that they'd actually gotten a divorce until it was brought up to me by Larry. Harsh fashion.
Gotcha.
Just
real quick. When you started training, when you first started training, were you already kind of aware of Larry Tatum and Kenpo? Just happened to be, that was the school that was...
It was convenient. And Kenpo is the only... since then, I've investigated a lot, tried a lot, attempted to learn a lot of other styles. But the only thing that I've ever gone into deeply has been Kenpo. And the only metric that I have for understanding other arts like Taekwondo or Capoeira or Hapkido is in comparison and very often and having students from there. We've got a lot of, for some reason, we get a lot of Shotokan students, or actually one Shotokai student here. And then I see what the differences are. And it was interesting in talking to you before we started about when you were talking about learning your capoeira and reverting back to Kenpo and saying, no, you can't do that. You got it. And it's such an interesting thing when you teach somebody who has a strong and workable and intelligent and functional other way of doing stuff. And you got to say, no, don't do that. Even though it works, it's like, you know, you're learning a new language. And just because you're really adept in German, now that you're working on Spanish, you can't use the same words or structures. Reminds me of hearing of, do you know a comedian named Eddie Izzard?
Yes.
Brilliant comedian. Brilliant. Mm-hmm. A brilliant guy. And watching him talk about doing comedy in Germany. Apparently I'm on a Germany kick today. And he didn't speak German, but he would do his routines, and he had to learn the language in order to do the comedy routines. And it's not just a matter of different words, but how they're structured and how they land and the structure of the language and where the adjectives come. And to build a joke, it's the same way it was making me think in listening to Eddie Izzard. I think there's a lot of similarities between stand-up and no gloves sparring, full contact sparring. You know, you can always end up dead either way.
Yeah, they both can be pretty
brutal stuff, and people are there for the same reason. If you've ever been to an open mic night and watch those guys, people are there because they, yeah, okay. It's the closest that we get, I think, to watching the old thing with the Romans and the lions and the Christians. Or, like I was saying before, also, like the early forms of Kenpo sparring at the Internationals in the 60s and 70s was that MMA without gloves or rules.
Yeah, gotcha. So Kenpo has been the only style that you've, you know, officially trained in, or have you done any other systems?
I would go to certainly seminars and practice and learn from other folks. And as Kenpo has no ground game, that, and I think for certainly good self-defense reasons, you don't want to end up on the ground. So don't go to the ground. But then what happens if you're on the ground? You need to, for years I had a Marcelo Carvalho, who's a brilliant teacher, one of the best teachers I know of anything. And he was with us teaching Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Initially, for the first few years, I was having him teach that. But then realizing, actually, we don't want to be teaching that. It's not so much to teach another art. If you want to do that, and it's a great idea, go to a BJJ school and focus on that. But if you're doing Kenpo, what a great idea it is to work out how to use. Somebody took you down on the ground, how to get up off the ground and back into, on your feet, Kenpo self-defense stuff. Because for one thing, you know, it's dirty, it's messy down there. You know, bugs die down there, you know. And people can get their head. There's all sorts of reasons not to be on the ground.
But yeah, with, no.
With our school, then we have ended up with these sporadic series. Well, certainly starting with Marcelo, teaching then. A regular weekly jiu-jitsu session for the people who wanted to do that. And then in our regular classes, those students would roll with other students, but it would always be that training of how to get up off the ground and back in. I then had, we lost Marcelo, the COVID shutdowns. He went back to Brazil for a while. It's just a long commute.
Yeah.
From Brazil to Los Angeles. And I thought he should make it, you know. I mean, come on. And then I had another teacher who, some various teachers, and it's still a work in progress. Because it is something that, I think that what Kenpo 5.0 has done, you know, incorporating jiu-jitsu into a sport aspect, you know, for like a scoring system for takedowns and strikes. Anto Parsegian runs the Speakman School up here and does a really fun job. You know what? So with all these people, I'm going to go to their seminars and stuff, but the only thing that I've fully, deeply trained in at all is Kenpo. And it might just be because, you know, I'm still working to get good at this. And like I say, teaching for 30 years. And also, I think once you hit your 70s, and when things break, it just takes a little bit longer to get back into line. And particularly with great stuff like jiu-jitsu, they do work on pulling joints out of line and backwards and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I just get less amenable to learning.
Yeah, I'm in a similar boat. I appreciate Brazilian jiu-jitsu and I, you know, have kind of dabbled in it a little bit, but I don't really have an interest in you know, training it full time. I definitely want, you know, learn how to deal with, you know, being on the ground and you know, like you said, once you get there, you know, get in and get out, sort of thing. But you know, as it stands right now, no, I'm not looking to train it full time. But you know, I definitely want some of that information because you know, as the Gracies and MMA and everything, you know, kind of open the world's eyes to ground fighting. That you know, it's something you got to have in your toolbox.
I wanted to ask you about, like I said, I'm a big fan of short three. Well, at my dojo, what we do, I teach. When you go to green, I teach short three first. And I don't know if you had it short three and long two. Is that your green? Did you do both?
Yes. Yes. Okay.
So I teach short three first. These are techniques you know. And you know what all of our techniques are counters. You know what the attack is. And this is your response to it. And I teach the right side to a student. And then they have to figure out the left side, and I will correct that for them. And then when they're done that, or while they're doing that, if they want, I will then teach them long two. I teach the pattern of long two, and I'm strict about that, then it has to be going this way. And I teach what the moves are, but now what I want to do with long two is to start to develop our black belt, which is it has to be about service and authority, really. A black belt has to be about a deeper understanding of what you're doing and why you're doing it. So with long two, well, first off, I make sure that they're rock solid back on short two again, because that's mm-hmm. your entire pattern of long two up until you finish the stabbies and you start mm-hmm. going backwards. You can go in chop chop, keeping your hands up for these stabs. You can go in and chamber down here. You can go in. I'm allowing them. You know, you can chamber back here so that you have. A little like in, you know, five swords, chamber down to the mm-hmm. hip rather than keeping it up is two. And making choices. So like the advantage of chambering down here as you block with your left is that you get torque going into the stab. Your advantage keeping your check up is that, well, you're protected. So mm-hmm. I want people to start making decisions about what works for them, why it works, and what they're going to do. So I'm allowing them leeway in doing long two. But what I don't do all the way through is tell them what it's for. So that we go all the way through learning the pattern as I've set it up. And incidentally, in case you chain with me here, I'm going to chamber mm-hmm. down here. Stab, stab. Then as they practice it, they can make some alterations then.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, when I first did it, when you have your vertical outward block, punch, 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 and then mm-hmm. Kick. I had that, and I learned that, and I did that as a sidekick. My last teacher, oh, incidentally, to finish my passage, after Rick, when I opened my own dojo, I had a friend, Maurice Gomez, asked me if he could use my studio. It was a different studio than this. Equal space, huge space, but we also had three private parking lots. We had parking for like 120 cars because it was a space that was going to, the owners of the block were looking to tear it down or were looking to sell. Although, and so I was able to afford living there in this beautiful studio with huge amounts of parking. His friend asked, could I use it for a seminar? And he created this thing he called the Power of Kenpo. We had eight black belts each come in to teach for an hour. I met so many people, Paul Dye and Bob White and Rich Hale. And anyhow, a lot, eight tremendous ones. And Mr. White became my teacher. Do you know Bob White? Did you?
I've been, you know, I've heard of him, but no, I hadn't had a chance to meet him. But I've heard of him.
Mr. White and I. And he was everything that I wanted in a teacher. He was, it was far more than teaching karate. It was also, well, certainly for Mr. White, it was teaching how to be a man, how to be a good person, and how to run a dojo, pretty much all kind of interweaves for me. I mean, why do any, it should be for your life's work, you know, something that you don't have to do just one or the other.
Actually,
Mr. White, I was just going to say, Mr. White did not do a sidekick in Long 2. He did a dead leg. You know what that is? Do you do that? Do you do that in Long 2 when you do it?
No.
Yeah, he did.
Well, when I started at the school, we did actually a front kick there.
Really?
And then at the school that now we do a sidekick. So.
Okay, well, Bob did a dead leg, and I was looking at that and going, well, geez, you know, what a clunky-looking kick. And he said, well, it's not really a kick. It was going back to, like, when he started, Bob was great. He was very different from me, pretty much every way. But he was a great fighter, and that's what took him to Kenpo, was the fighting. And his Kenpo dojo was... It just owned the internationals and had more first place trophies, more of those, you know, the Torii Gate internationals trophies than any other dojo ever. That was when he started. That dead leg was an allowed thing. And he's talking about one fighter who just did it all the time because it comes up and it stops, you know, at the 45. So it's at knee level for someone to run into. So someone's charging you and you're back. And it's kind of like that short two thing where someone's running into, you know, your neutral bow. But in this case, they're running, they're like their knees running into your kick. So you're not kicking it out. It's, but it's devastating because, you know, we're then, okay, let's try this. And it is, I think, you can't do it anymore in point fighting, but it's awfully effective. And one of the things that I look to in teaching kata and teaching, I'd say pretty much in teaching everything, after blue belt, maybe green, certainly for all the browns and all the extensions, is a lot of times we're introducing an unusual weapon or a different way of doing something. I think fundamentally after orange or purple, you got great skills. As Mr. Lee pointed out, you know, you don't need to fear the guy who does 200 different kicks. You need to fear the guy who's done that one kick to him, or let's say 2,000, 20,000 times. You know,
more the merrier.
Yeah, it's get good at something simple rather than learning a whole lot of different stuff. And that we have so many weird things, you know, like an inverted dragon knuckle hit in at least that we do in your claws. I insist on those when I teach the techniques and now the dead leg and long two so that folks can be introduced to different things, different weapons. But then once you get them, by the time, and this is green is your final color belt, you go into brown, I want you to start making decisions about what works for you and what doesn't. Our test to black belt, you have to make up your own kata going to brown for us. When do you do it? You make your first kata?
Well, we actually kind of do that starting around purple.
Oh, good.
During the test, it kind of increases. So, like the first one, like you know, have to take you know five techniques and you know kind of
nice.
Do it on the spot.
Well done. Then, we'll do it on the spot.
Yeah, and then blue, it's to, 10, and it kind of increases from there.
You're doing the test. Do you get to just do them, or do people call out, do begging hands, flashing wings, obscure?
No, you just do it. It's like, okay, this is, now it's time for you to do your personal form, take 5 techniques, and.
But this is something you come in, you've practiced, you've prepared.
supposed to, but it never works. It never seems to work out that way.
Do you ever do self-defense in tournaments?
No.
You know, the self-defense competition?
Yeah. I've seen it. I didn't compete very much. Well, really, hardly at all. I mean, you could count on one hand the amount of tournaments I did, and I spectated a lot of them, but competing never really got. I never really kind of got into it.
It can be a very long day. Internationals here again, and I was also never much a competitor, except. As I was going on, I realized, I'm used to, it sounds to me like you've tested yourself against a whole lot of different people all through your life. And like I said, I just started with this one art.
Mm-hmm.
And although now I've done it through 3 schools, it's generally been with people that I know. So in order to know if it works, I got to do it. I got to go away and meet strangers, mm-hmm. meet people that might treat me with respect. We might eventually end up being buddies, but fundamentally they don't care if I go home really unhappy, they want to go home with that. And I think that's important, particularly I see a lot more value in it for kids. But anyhow, for the self-defense in Kenpo tournaments, it's you do that with another student where, you do 5 swords, long kimono, thrusting salute. Like for color belts, I think it's 3, and brown belt, black belt is 5. And you do that once slow to show what the thing is. And you do it once at street speed, like a real fight. And it's so cool. So much fun when you see it done well and you see it like an actual fight where, I think one of the main problems with Kenpo is also our main value is these techniques. You know what's going to happen. You know how to allow the contact. And you can practice real powerful contact with safety, but it also creates these things that when we attack for 5 swords, I'll go here and I'm waiting as you go chop, chop, chop. And so, you don't get actual reactions and the interest of safety. And when you see these self-defense techniques, they'll truncate them down to saying, I'm going this way. So I'm going to come in with something else. And it comes on a nicely choreographed street fight. Mm-hmm. And you get to see actual stuff. Anyhow, that's kind of the thing that I'm looking for very much with Long 2. I want these folks, my students, to then say, okay, here's the thing you got. What is it? This is the move, right? The downward block, back knuckle, punch, and then you got kick, punch, punch, near the end. What's the attack? How come you're doing that? And I forbid my teachers from telling them, giving them an answer until the student gives them an answer. So that, and to also, I think one of the problems with Kenpo is we do tend to get a bit talky about stuff. And I like the notion that every disagreement we have about what works or doesn't is best settled just on the mat, just try it out without, you're not breaking people. If, you break it, you buy it, so you got to take care of it for the next, however long it takes to go buy them soup and stuff.
But what you do on somebody, you have to remember that they get to do it to you afterwards. So gotta take it easy on your UK there.
Yeah, very, very much is that. Let me ask you one thing that, so that gets us into what do you teach? What do you use Kenpo? Or what do you use teaching kata for? Sorry, that just made me think of, Michael Jai White.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And one of his, it's just a just fine actors, just extraordinary martial artist. And from all these little videos I've seen, just a wonderful teacher, teaching simple stuff well. Or in his movies, he's teaching you. One of them has to do with the value of kata. Or, of course, he's the guy over on the side of the manly man gym, and everybody's like, nay, nay. And he's over and he's doing his kata, and the MMA guys are going, yeah, yeah, pussy, come on up here. Which, you know, for one thing, it's a little bit, I mean, nobody could look at Michael Jai White and go, here's a guy I can pick on. I mean, you do that, you're being silly. And then, of course, he demonstrates how to use kata. But here, when we do it in Kenpo, there are, I think, some very strong schools of thought. And my teacher, Bob Wai, was very much of, yeah, you can work on techniques and alter to make it fit, but never change the kata. I do have a specific question to ask you, but how do you stand on that? Do you, or does your teacher, do you know if he's ever changed kata, what you're learning?
As far as I know, it hasn't been changed.
Well, you said that front kick. That was in another school. You did the front kick.
Yeah, that was at my original school. So,
and that's one of the questions. You like have one school, you got another school. Mm-hmm. They say never change stuff, but then you go to another school and they say never change stuff. Just do it the way I say.
Yeah.
Is what I say at my school. Never change. Do it the way I say, unless I change my mind. In which case, change stuff.
Well, actually, kind of two things that what you just said kind of made me think of. One of the prominent figures in the Capoeira world, man goes by the name of Mestre Cordion. He is kind of famous for saying, "Don't do what I say, do what I want."
Okay,
you know, just hearing it doesn't make sense, but when he says it, everybody instantly knows what he's talking about, and it makes sense, which it shouldn't, but yeah, that made me think of that. As far as the form goes, so at my first school, I say it's essentially a Tracy school, but we didn't refer to it as that way. I kind of prefer to think of it as more of a Ed Parker 1.0. So the lineage of my particular school, Ed Parker taught the Tracys. The Tracys, then one of their black belts, by a man by the name of Dick Willett, went off and started his school. And then one of his black belts, Orned Chicken Gabriel,
was my first.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Just kind of one of the, at least definitely, I mean, he's, nationally ranked, tournament fighter and, produced a lot of, just amazing competitors and whatnot. So that was my teacher's, my first instructor's instructor. So we did, kind of the Ed Parker 1.0, version of the forms and whatnot. It's my understanding that, the Tracy, the current Tracy's curriculum is a little bit different than what I learned. I don't know how much it's changed. I would assume not a whole lot, but it was a little bit different. So kind of contrasting my previous training to training now, for the most part, the movements and the forms are the same, but just little slight tweaks here and there. So one example in Long Two, when I originally learned it, after that kind of the first kind of, block and chop, you're throwing a palm strike. So,
still going forward?
Yeah. So that second, when you engage that second hand, it's a palm strike instead of a spear hand.
Yeah.
So
little
things like that. That are different.
You know, some very experienced fighters who just, I teach, and I would accept that if someone said they were going to change it to that. I teach it with the spear. Mm-hmm. Then, like, one of my guys. He actually, he joined me from the Friday Night Line guys. One of the only people here older than I am. It's a comfort to have. But he'll never do any daggers. I don't think he does any Kenpo hands either. Because he's worried about, you know, you're going to bust up your fingers. Which, again, like after in your 60s, those folks, you don't want to break them on stuff.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Yeah. So, like, you have that downward block, back knuckle, punch, kick, punch, mm-hmm. right? And going into the corner.
Yeah.
Right? So what is that a counter to for you? That downward block, back knuckle, punch.
Gosh. Yes, I would see that as, you know, you're blocking, you know, like a front kick and then, okay. you know, countering.
You see, this is just what I make my students go through and say, mm-hmm. okay, and make them do it with other people where they have to tell another student. For when, like I said, that going to black belt is also about authority. It's about making choices and figuring out things and standing by them and being able to not answer stuff with not because I was told to. Or that's not the way to start out. Sure. Do you know the Kenpo black belt light bulb joke?
Something you know along
many,
the lines.
You know how many Kenpo Ed Parker black belts it takes to screw in a light bulb? I'll tell you, Mr. Dark. It takes 4,708. That's 4,000. Well, that's 4,708. That's one to screw in the light bulb. And that's 4,807 to tell you that's not the way Mr. Parker showed me.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't get more than two Kenpo people in a room without there being some disagreement about something, you know, technique or form or principle or, you know, something. So,
which, you know, I think is actually one of the things that made Kenpo alive, and I think to a huge degree it drives people nuts. And I think it was one of the things that you know, a few years back, the daughter, when they wanted to take control of it and created their company CAM4, wanted to say they were the people who could decide everything. I think that one of the things that actually gave Kenpo vitality was that Mr. Parker died so unfortunately young. You know, at 50, and mm-hmm. it's interesting now, you know, the older I get, I'm sure that there was a time when I would have thought 59 was old, but it's not, and it wasn't then. And he was, you know, and certainly for him, I bet he would have had plans, because he was, besides, you know, the effect he had on martial art, I think he had an equally significant effect on just the whole notion of making a business out of this thing. No, this is my living, and I've always been able to make a living doing what I wanted to do. But to make a living, like for one thing, I said I didn't start doing martial arts until I was 40, and to think, well, okay, that's going to be a career, is a little bit nuts. And what Parker did was, he really encouraged. He had people starting their own dojos pretty quickly. You know, going out and spreading, and certainly things that were like very clearly outside of his control. Which I think he did share one of Bob White's sayings. He had a lot of pithy ones. I don't know. I'm sorry I wasn't able to share your capoeira teacher's mm-hmm. saying with him, because that he would have loved that. But he did have one where he said he's sorry. He would have to tell a student, "I'm sorry if I gave you the impression that this was a democracy." Because a dojo isn't and can't really be. Although you do want to listen to all those, the input of people that you respect and you know, figure out what works there. But you really just do need to have that one voice. And I think he would have wanted to have or had planned to have a succession. But when he died, there was the only 10th degree black belt. And I had always felt, when I started with Larry Tatum, Larry was, might have been an 8th. No, I think he was a 9th. And I felt, that's it. I mean, there only ever can be one who starts it. But then in the ensuing years, I mean, there's hundreds of Kenpo black belts as people just made themselves black belts. And Bob never did, Bob White. And I'd see all these pictures of him, you know, surrounded by, you know, 30, 40 Kenpo 10th degree black belts. And he was always be right in the center, outranking them as a 9th degree, to my mind, at any rate. But he would be there, front and center, the 9th degree with all these 10th degrees around. And I think that, you know, as he, well, it was after he got cancer and fought it off, he decided he'd been urged to go to black belt, go to 10th degree for many years, since the death of Mr. Park. And his promotion to 10th degree was one of the most definitive moments of Kenpo for me, of what a dojo is, what a community is. He had, do you know Eddie Downey? Do you know Mr. Downey?
That name sounds familiar.
He's head of the European Kenpo Federation. He has like 30 studios in Ireland. And you'll see him, there's, back in his younger days, there's some video of him, I think it is in Ireland, and Ed Parker, and a TV interview thing, and demonstrating some stuff. Yeah, he's one of the old-time, long-time originals. Mr. Downing was out, and it was down at Bob's studio in Costa Mesa, which is actually kind of a small place, but the room was completely filled with his black belts and folks like Eddie Downey, who, you know, had always, he was part of that organization. There are people of equal rank and all these. I believe 10th degrees as well, but the room was just jam packed with a whole lot of red, black and red. And Mr. Downey came out with the belt and handed it to this little girl from Ireland, who came up and with the belt, and they passed it around the room. This is what was remarkable. This is just astounding, man. I keep running into these things that just knock me over with the room full of black belts. This was just passed around, handed to the person, handed to the next person, handed to the next person. Nobody said anything. Nobody said, this is what you're supposed to do. Nobody announced the drill. And some people would bow to the belt. Some people bowed to Mr. Maybe a couple people said a couple of words. But it just went around to every single black belt in the room without instruction. And we would get I bow to the belt, lift it up and pass it to the person next to me. And everybody made sure that every black belt in the room took hold of that belt and passed it all the way back to the other side through all of his teaching staff to Mrs. White, who took the belt and passed it to Bob, went back to Mr. Downing, and it was presented to him. It was just the most extraordinary thing. It was because I was, well, how do you get to be a 10th degree? And that was the answer. Because you can't be promoted. There isn't anybody high enough to promote you. No, your community promotes you.
Yeah, I like that. It's very, they have a very similar thing to that in Capoeira when you get up to those advanced ranks that, it's based on the community, you know, providing you with that title and, you know, less about, oh, well, you know, I, you know these, you know, 154 techniques or anything like that. It's what have you provided to the community? What have you provided to your fellow brothers and sisters and promoting the art? And, you know, that's when, you know, you earn that title. So I like that. As we kind of head towards a close here, I mean, of course, we could go on forever and ever and ever and ever, and you know, we'll definitely have to do, you know, part 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 12 and so forth. I have a few just kind of fun little questions to kind of wrap up for today, and we've kind of touched on these a little bit, but you know, we'll kind of get the official answer here. The first one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Raining claw. It's just
nice one.
It's that your hands are up, you're gathering them in, and you're hitting them with stuff. We do sometimes we do a gauntlet line, and just everything that comes at me, I'm just going, you know, yeah, it's protecting, defending, checking, and striking.
I like it. I like it. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
I'd say that, like I said, I love short three, unless I'm teaching something else. Then no, I love long four. And wait, you know, I really, it's long eight. I love how you turn the knives around. Mm-hmm. But I just love the simplicity of short form too. But I don't tell the other kata because they'll get sad about it. But I think really short three is my fave.
Gotcha. Okay.
And incidentally, it does not end at the same spot. It's got to.
If there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
That'd still Mr. Excellent. Bob White. Excellent. He defined what it is to be a teacher.
I like it. All right. And then our final question here, in honor of Ed Parker's love of jokes and humor, do you have a joke that you'd like to share?
I'm still going with how many black belts does it take to go in a light bulb? Because it defines the stuff. Quite honestly, I should come up with another one, but I'm afraid that's the one that tells the story.
Now,
here's another one, actually, from another great black belt, Mike Pick. Do you know Mike Pick?
Yes.
I think I have his book of poetry.
Or I should say, I know of him, and I have reached out to him to be on the show.
He's an interesting man, very interesting man. And like I think his Vietnam experience did a great deal to shape him. His book of poetry is about that. It's about what it is to be a soldier and to kill. He also, I had bonsai at my studio when he visited, and he gave me some real tips on how to take care of bonsai and use buttermilk in them. But I had my bonsai inside, and what he neglected to point out is that you got to do that for outdoor bonsai, because if you actually pour a bunch of buttermilk into a bunch of dirt, in a couple of weeks, you can have a really stinky place. But so he was also a blacksmith, and he told me this joke about blacksmithing, which, I translated from blacksmithing to running a dojo. So there's these three friends, the priest, the actor. I changed everything about it except for the punchline. The priest, the actor, and the dojo owner. And they just gotten their lotto tickets, and the prize was up to $1.5 billion. And they're going, whoa, man. They go, just what are you gonna do with that? And the priest goes, well, you know, I'm gonna start an orphanage here in town, and it's gonna all these kids who've had just horrible lives that they've lost people who will guide them, and I want to have a loving place for them to grow and scholarships for them to continue on in life, and a warm and loving safe place for them to be people. And they go, whoa, man, that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I hope you win. I hope you win. I get that's great. What are you going to do? And the actor goes, well, I am going to travel the world. I want to go to every culture. I want to see every people. I want to understand every feeling there is. I want to understand what it is to live and try and survive in a jungle. I want to understand what Sherpas have to go through when they go up to the top of that mountain. I want to understand what it is to be a fish. I want to understand everything. I'm going to spend every penny I have to experience everything I got. And they go, whoa, man, I wish I could do that. That's the best. And they turn to the martial artist and say, so what are you going to do? And the guy goes, well, I reckon I'll just keep running the dojo till the money runs out.
I like that. That's good. That's very good. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, I really, really thank you for being on. And
my pleasure.
Thanks sharing your story, and just can't thank you enough for your time. This is now the point for shameless self-promotion. So anything that you want to throw out there or say that maybe we haven't touched on that you want to get out there, now is your
time. That's very kind. Honest to God, all I want to do is just keep running the dojo till the money runs out.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, yeah, no, thank you again. And I will be in touch when this is ready to go out. yeah, I thank you so much for being on. And
thank you, Mr. Darden. It's a pleasure talking to you, man.
Yeah, same here. We will talk again soon. So thank you.